Blog Talk Radio.
Of your personal finance with Dr. Charles Ross, the show that helps you budget, conserve, and save and invest your money. But you know, one of the interesting things about that is that it's always important that we learn, you know, sometimes how to motivate ourselves. So joining me on today is Jarrett. They call him Jarrett J. Andrews Smith. Is one of the nation's leading motivators and coaches on life, finances, and relationships. He's dubbed as the voice of the underdog, and he uses his unique style and personality to really connect with his audience. He's a speaker and author of the book Success Is My Prey. Jarrett has established himself as a thought leader and trusted voice throughout America, and Jarrett is best known for helping people maximize their full potential by giving them the inspiration, tools, and resources needed in life. Hello, Jarrett. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing mighty fine, mighty fine. Glad to have you on the show. So we're going to dive right in. Your book is called Success Is My Prey. Now, you're a young guy, you know. You're a young guy.
Yeah.
You're only, what, 27?
Yes, sir, 27.
27, okay. So how did you get into motivational speaking? How did that happen at such a young age?
So my first dive into motivational speaking was about 10 years ago when I actually was incarcerated in jail down in Atlanta, which is where I grew up at, in Atlanta. And being in jail, I was able to impact other inmates, and I was able to speak life into other people, even in the midst of my situation. So that was actually my first hint at getting into motivational speaking or motivational, into the motivational industry, really, you know, just start speaking to people. And ever since then, I've just been, you know, talking to as many people as I can, or people come up to me and talk to me, or they may call me for advice and things like that. And people have always told me over the years that, hey, you should be a motivational speaker, you should be a preacher, you should be this. And at first, I wasn't taking it quite thick. I just knew it was just something that always came to me naturally. I just love to help people, and I just love to talk. Like, those are the two most things about myself. Like, I love to talk, and I love to help people. I knew that about myself, and it just came natural. But I didn't see myself actually doing it on a serious level, like a serious scale, like I'm doing now. So once I got serious about it, and then I really started, you know, really started diving into, okay, hey, maybe this is my gift. This is the gift that God blessed me with. So let me really tap into it and see what I can do with it. So that's where I'm at today.
So you know, you shared this in your introduction as to how you got into motivational speaking, that you were in prison. Are you at liberty to share what you were convicted of?
Yeah, yes, sir. So I was convicted on 4 felony counts when I was 17. It was 2 assault and batteries, and it was armed robbery, and it was a strong armed robbery. It was that they mainly got me for the strong armed robbery, which is what I was convicted of, and I was facing 20 years of prison. So I wasn't set to really come out of prison until I was like 37 years old.
Wow.
Since I had went in at 17, yeah. So, but I was able to do felony probation, which I didn't have to do any prison time. I just had to do felony probation. But the stipulations were that I stay out of trouble, I get in school, get into college, and stay out of trouble. My judge wanted to see me elevate in my life. And my judge really made a positive impact during my case. She spoke so much life into me, even when she couldn't have, or you know, she didn't have to do it, but she did. And so once she convicted me of the armed robbery, I went on felony probation, and I done that for 2 years, and I completed that in 2013. And then after I completed that, the charges automatically came off my record as though I never got into any trouble. And so my record was wiped back clean, and I've been good ever since then and everything. So yeah, but I mainly went in for strong armed robbery.
What's strong armed robbery? What is that?
Okay, yeah. So you got you got burglary, which is breaking into people's house. You have robbery, which is just simply I take your possession. And then you have strong armed robbery, or you have armed robbery, which is I tell you that I have a gun on me, give me what you got, but I don't physically show the gun. Strong armed robbery is when I physically put the gun to your head and make you give me what you got. That's strong armed robbery.
Right. Wow. So, you know, what led you to put a gun to somebody's head and, you know, I guess obviously threaten to kill them if they didn't give you what they had? What led you down that path? Because let me tell you where I'm going with this, because I'm an educator, right? And I'm in middle school, and one of the things that I find with a lot of my students is, you know, they got this, you know, gruff attitude, you know, I'm not afraid of nobody, you know, I want to live that thug life, you know what I'm talking about, right? Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So my question is that, so what led? Because I always say when I see something on the news, Jared, and I hear about someone like yourself who gets arrested for whatever, for robbery, for murder, for assault, I always say, well, you know, go back to his public school record. There's something in there that would tell you that this would happen. Am I right about that?
And you absolutely right about that. That's what I always look at when I see other stories on the news or I hear other people. I don't just look at their situation for what just happened. I always like do a deep dive. Okay, is something somewhere that triggered them to go that direction? Because don't nobody just be born or just wake up one day and say, hey, I want to go rob people. You know,
right?
We become triggered, and what led me down that route was. There's a few different factors that plays a role. One factor is my environment that I grew up in. I grew up in the Section 8, the poverty environment, where I only saw drug dealing, robberies, and gang banging and things like that. So I didn't see any form of success around me. The only success I seen was successful drug dealers riding by with the nice big cars and all the money, and they had all the females. So that to me is what I thought success was about, and I thought that's what my life had to be about. That was one factor that led me that way. Another factor is, and this is a big one, which is why I like talking to your audience, such as middle schoolers and high schoolers and people like that, because another reason that led me that way was getting with the wrong kind of friends and allowing that peer pressure from friends really impact me, because at heart, in my heart, and who I was growing up, I never was that guy. You know, when I got arrested, it shocked the whole community. It shocked a lot of people, because, you know, growing up, I was an athlete. I did pretty good in school. I had pretty good grades in school. Actually, in high school, I had a 4.0 GPA throughout most of my high school career. So, almost 4.0, not exactly 4.0, maybe around 3.5, a little bit. Yeah, I don't want to, my bad, I don't want to exaggerate. But I don't know, I had a pretty good high school career academically. I was in sports, and so it shocked a lot of people. And it even shocked me, because I didn't realize where my mindset had gone during that time. And I was hurt by not having a father figure in my life also. I wanted my dad in my life, but my dad wouldn't be in my life, and that hurt me. Not to put the blame on him or anything. I don't blame anybody for my actions, but these are just a few things that triggered me, that led me down that route. And then one of the other biggest things that led me down that route was, once again, growing up in that environment I grew up in, but having a single mom who I seen raising four children, and I just wanted to lighten the burden off of her some way. You know, I tried to go get a regular job. I tried to go to McDonald's, and I tried to, you know, just get some little, you know, just go get a little burger job somewhere, mm-hmm. that I could just make some money to help mom out. But jobs in Atlanta wasn't really hiring around that time. That was around the 08-09 crisis. So, you know, jobs wasn't really hiring around that time. Me and my family had went homeless in that process. So I'm sleeping at homeless shelters in Atlanta. So it's my mom and her four kids, and we bouncing around from hotels and homeless shelters and things like that. And so, you know, my friends had already been involved in the street, and I had already been hanging around with them. And so something, you know, well, not I know what told me, but, you know, it was the friends and something that told me and said, you know, well, just get out here and just try to do the best you can and make as much money to take care of yourself so your mom wants to take care of you. She can focus on the other three siblings. And so that went, like, those are just some different factors that motivated me to going down that route. And even though in my mind, when I told myself, okay, I'm going to rob this person so I can help my mom, even though that's what I told myself, that still wasn't right. Could I still rob innocent people of their hard-earned money just for my personal gain, regardless of my situation, you know? And I shouldn't have done it. And so that's where I'm at today. But during that time, that's just all I knew. And that's what I seen. That's what I knew. So I felt like that's what I had to do.
I get you. Yeah, and, you know, you share something that is real key, because about your environment. What part of Atlanta did you grow up in?
Okay, so I lived in Decatur, but I also I did most of my growing up in Gwinnett County, around Lawrenceville area, Norcross. And so I did a lot of my raising up around Jimmy Carter, which most people know back in 2009, Jimmy Carter was one of the worst places to be in Georgia, mm-hmm. just because the amount of gang violence we had and the amount of violence period we had.
And that's really key. You know, the school I teach at is in, I don't know if you're familiar with the University Avenue, Prior Road kind of area over there off of, okay. I guess, 7585 South. You've seen the news at all, and the Wendy's that was on fire, did you see that on the news?
I think I heard about it. I don't think I got a chance to see it yet.
Yeah, well, anyway, everybody's kind of, if they've been following the whole, you know, protesting, that my school is about two blocks from there, and so the average income in the 30315 is about $22,000 to $23,000 a year. Only one out of four residents have a high school diploma. I mean, you got really, really extreme poverty. You know, you have multi generational poverty. Most of the students that go to my school are single, you know, live in a single female headed household. Dads are not involved. And so what you're confirming for me, not that I needed that confirmation, that the environment, number one, the environment, okay. Number two, the wrong friends. They think everybody's their friend. You know, you can't have 10 friends. You may have, if you're lucky in life, you know, as you know, growing up young, is that you may have one or two good friends who got your back, you know.
Right.
The rest of folks are associates, people you hang out with, go party with, go play ball with or whatever. They're not just your friends. And then the third thing is that you know, well, or I already mentioned it, the fact that, you know, the dad wasn't in your life and good athlete. I mean, I have students that have had challenges with all of that stuff and do it. And then the homeless factor. Yeah, that's another thing. There's a lot of tentative family financial situations, if you know what I mean. Paycheck to paycheck, you know, living week to week, basically. So if anything falls out of pocket, anything comes up, you know, you messed up, you know, and you're going to have to shuffle things around to pay the rent and all that kind of stuff. So that's really good. So did your record get expunged so you can say that you know, have not been a convicted felon when you apply for, if you were to apply for a job or loan, aid that, was it expunged?
Right. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, my. Okay. Once I completed my felony probation, my record became expunged back clean as though I never got in trouble. So I was able to apply for any job I wanted to.
Okay. Awesome. So where do you live now?
I'm now in Greenville, South Carolina.
Greenville, South Carolina. Okay. And how did you end up in Greenville? Because Atlanta's a great city. So, Greenville's a small town.
Yeah. Greenville is growing, but I will be making my return back to Atlanta, hopefully in the near future, bring my daughters and my wife down. But how I ended up in Greenville, well, actually, my family history is from South Carolina, but my mom moved to Georgia when I was very, very little. So that's how I practically ended up being from Georgia. But when we went homeless, and 2010, once we went homeless, and I was on, I had got bunded out from jail in January of 2010, and I was on house arrest for 8 months during my case, you know, me going back and forth to court, but I had to be on house arrest. And so the house arrest was another extra payment that my mom had to keep up with, which that wasn't cheap. And so we just had so many bills over our head to where we finally hit flat rock bottom, and we were in the shelter, then went from the shelter to, okay, well, now we can't even really be in the shelter because you have to be in the shelter by a certain time, and if you're not in there by a certain time, then you have to sleep on the street that night, you know. So we had to turn to the last resort, which is my mom. She didn't want to come back to South Carolina because of her history here, but my aunt, I had an aunt and my uncle who lived here in South Carolina that was doing pretty good for themselves. And they had allowed us to come back or come here and live with them until my mom got on her feet good. And I've just been here ever since.
Okay. And so, take us through. I'm assuming you got arrested at 17. You're a high school. Were you a senior at that time?
Yeah. I was my senior year of high school, and I couldn't even finish high school that year.
Okay. And so you got your GED. And
right. So
give us a glimpse of the 10-year span between 17 and 27. And, you know, when did you start your business now is that your full-time business or side hustle? I mean, you know, or writing, which is it full-time? Or
okay. Yeah, No, it's not full-time yet. I still work a full-time 9-to-5. So it's
okay.
Not quite full-time yet. But, you know, we getting there, though. So I started my first business when I'm 27, I think, 4 years ago, 2016. Yeah, so I was 23, maybe turning 24 when I first started my first business.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you sound like me. One of the things, the influence that helps a lot is your family. You know, my dad, I grew up in New York City, in the Bronx, in the project, and my dad owned two dry cleaners, and I just, you know, when I always knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur, and I finally, you know, bit the bullet at about, I guess I was about 28, you know, when I started my radio show, and then, you know, other things, you know, I wrote a couple of books and that kind of thing, but you know, one of the things is the influences that has, you know, that you want to, you know, get something out of it. And I've been telling people, you know, whoever would listen, that, you know, during this pandemic, since we're all sheltered in place, you got time on your hand, you might not be working or you're working from home. If you don't come out of this pandemic with a new skill or a more knowledge or a side hustle, then you don't lack time. You just lack discipline. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because you have the time. you just ain't doing it. And it takes, as you well know, it as a successful motivational speaker and writer, that it takes discipline. Because a lot of times you don't get up feeling like you want to hit a lick. You know what I'm saying? You know, you might as well stay in bed, you know, not go work out or not, you know, start putting your dream together and calling people, you know, if what you're doing requires sales and stuff like that. Everybody can't do that, you know. They want the glory, but they don't want the hustle that comes with it. And, you know, so, but, you know, so I like to interview young folks like you. They give me hope that things can, you know, can happen, you know, for you. And I'm sure the judge, have you reached out to the judge and let her know how you're doing? Because I'm sure she'd want to know that you made the right choice and giving you that felony probation.
Right. I've been trying to, but she has retired. So she has since, I think she retired about 2 years ago, and I haven't been able to track her down. But I've been wanting to get her a copy of my book and let her know. Because she really spoke a lot of life into me, and she didn't have to do that, but she did, and I can't thank her enough. I mean, she's one of the key people in my young life that really motivated me to getting better, especially with my first bun hearings. I mean, she told me directly, she said, you know, young man, normally I don't give buns out for this type of charge in my court, but I just see something in you. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it yet, but I just see something in you. And she just, you know, she's been speaking life into me since day one of my case. And she was actually, when I moved to South Carolina, and Georgia did not want to cooperate to transfer my probation from Georgia to South Carolina, she was going to drop the charges just because of that if Georgia didn't want to cooperate. Because she, I had just got into to school trying to finish my GED and things like that, and she actually seen my progress, what I'm trying to make, and she didn't want to take me away from it. And so she spoke a lot of life into me. So hopefully I could try to track her down one day, see if I could track her down somehow. I know she lives in Gwinnett County. I know that.
That's awesome, you know, and I'm sure she would like to know, and you know, how you're doing. So let's dive into my book, okay? And so you decided to write a book. Tell us about that story, because I've written two books, and I know what that journey's like, okay?
The book, writing the book,
everybody thinks they want to write a book. I think everybody has a book in them, okay? Now, it's a question whether anybody will read the book. You know? So everybody has a story, and, you know, it's just a question of whether, you know, you have the discipline to be able to write it, whether it's about yourself or some topic or hobby that you have. You know, it just varies, you know. So everybody has a book in them. So tell us about your journey, you know, when you decided to write a book, and, you know, what that process was like.
Okay. So I decided to write a book in 2016. So I had made the decision. I said, okay, I'm going to write a book one day. But the thing is, I kept saying one day. I never attached a deadline to it. I just kept saying one day. And so because I kept saying one day, you know, I procrastinated for so long. I started taking notes from my book in 2016. I started, you know, calling family and talking to some of my family about some of my personal experiences that I went through, just to make sure that I had my personal memory in order, that my memory served me well and everything. So I started that process, but I just never, like, and I would start writing, but then I would stop, but then I would start, but then I would stop. So I did that on and off for, you know, a few years. And then last year in 2019, at January 2019, I told myself, I said, okay, no more playing around. It's time for me to lock in and focus on really getting this book finished. And so I finished up the writing part of it last year, and then but I know it was still so much more that I did not know about publishing the book, you know, about finding publishers or finding graphic designers and things like that. So I reached out to a mentor who I had already adopted him as my virtual mentor, but I made a personal connection. I reached out to him to see if I can get a little bit more mentor from him. He's wrote 8 books himself and 4 bestsellers. And he's down in Atlanta. His name is Ash. I don't know if you heard of him or not. But
what's his name?
Ash what? Cash.
No, I can't say I've heard of him. No, that doesn't mean anything. No.
Okay, yeah. Right. Yeah, I got you. Yeah, so Ash Cash, he's actually from New York as well, like yourself. So I reached out to him for some mentoring, and you know, paid him for some mentoring just to really show me the ropes to how to really get my book out, publish it, and really market it and things like that. So I was able to finish my book writing last year, and this year I said, okay, January 1st this year, I said June 12th, 2020, I would be releasing the book. And so that gave me 6 months to finish everything, to fully get the book sent off for editing and sent back to me, and finish every single thing I needed to get done with, whether copywriting, whatever I need to get done with the book. I need to tie everything up and have it done by June 12th. And that's what I did. So I finally attached the deadline, which June 12th became my deadline, and I worked backwards from there. At first, I was just trying to work forward, like, okay, I'm going to write a book one day. But then when I actually attached the deadline to it, and I just started working backwards from there.
And you say they. Is that the publishing company that published, or did you self-publish?
No, I self-published. Well, as Ash Cash called it, I self-published.
Yeah, writing a book, just a brief, insight into how when I wrote my books is that, and I went with a publishing company, Thomas Nelson Publishing, which is actually a Christian publisher, but their claim to fame is that they have one of the biggest impacts in getting their Christian books in secular, stores. But anyway, I got an advance, so they gave me money, half of the money up front, the rest when I delivered. And I got down to about a month before, man, and I just, because I was doing some other things. This is about 25 years ago, okay? So I was rocking and rolling, man. I had my radio show. I was writing a newspaper column. I was doing some TV stuff. I mean, I was touring, doing college tour of with a company called MasterCard, teaching young kids how to budget their money. But anyway, so one of the things, I just had to go get secluded. I went into a cabin up in Helen, Georgia, and sequestered myself for a week, and I finished the book in 1 week. All I did was write, sleep, eat, and go to the bathroom. That's it. and I finished it in 7 days, man. So, and that helped me, because when I had to write my, dissertation, that helped me because I had the discipline. I wrote every day. I wrote, no matter if I wrote one page or 20 pages, I would sit down at the computer and I would write. And then people ask me, how do you write? I said, you got to do it every day. I said, it's like working out or anything else. You got to write every day, because it ain't, I understand now why a lot of writers were alcoholics, because it's very lonely. Nobody can help you with that. It's just you and that computer, or back in the day it was you and that typewriter. And sometimes it just ain't happening. But so I applaud you on that. So now let's get into some of the things that you talk about in your book. But before we do that, I want you to think about the questions of how do you achieve all of your goals in life? So give us some tips on that. So we're going to take a break and listen to a segment of one of my vignettes of Your Personal Finance, and then we'll be back with Jared Smith. Well, maybe not.
Okay. A financial mistake that can be avoided with a little bit of magic. Find out what it is on today's Your Personal Finance.
Here's great news about a special introductory offer from the Wall Street Journal. Now, for a limited time, you can have 13 weeks of the Wall Street Journal delivered to your home or office every business day for just 57 cents a day, 25% off the Journal's regular price, for the world's most trusted source of business news and information, for the insights, analysis, and big picture thinking you need to make better decisions, more confident decisions, decisions that can make all the difference to you, your family, and your future. So make a smart decision right now. See for yourself how you can profit from the knowledge you get from the Wall Street Journal every business day. Take advantage of the Journal's special introductory offer, 13 weeks for the low price of just 57 cents a day. This offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S. only.
Call now toll free 1-800-262-7300. That's 1-800-262-7300 for the Wall Street Journal.
Saving for the future is the key to financial security. Having money in the bank gives you more control when there's an emergency and more flexibility when there's an unexpected opportunity. Yet many people mistakenly see saving money as an impossible goal. It doesn't have to be. Even if you only put aside a few dollars each week, start the habit now. And then, watch the magic. You put money in a savings account, you earn interest, the interest is compounded, which means added onto your balance, and you earn interest on the higher amount. The best way to save is through payroll deduction or having the bank withdraw money from your checking account and put it into a savings account. The most important thing is to decide what amount you can save each week and then do it. For your personal finance, I'm Charles Ross.
And we're back. Your personal finance with Dr. Charles Ross, talking with Jared Smith. He is the author of the book Success is My Prey. So how did you come up with that type of title? Why did you name it Success is My Prey? It's an interesting title.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate it. In 2016, I had, because I'm always writing motivational quotes on my mirror in my house. So I'm always on my bathroom mirror, on my living room mirror, I always got a quote up. And so one day, I just wrote that on my mirror. And I just wrote it on my mirror one day, and I said, success in my prey. And then it just stuck with me from there. From that point forward, it just stuck with me. It just became my motto to life, my way of life on how I attack my goals in life every single day. And so it just stuck with me from there. And then on top of that, I love lions. So I'm always viewing myself as a lion in a way, or with a lion mentality on the way I attack my goals in life. And so I just combined the two thoughts like that, and I just, you know, it just stuck with me from there. So I think, you know, I think my first book gonna be named This Is My Break.
Oh wow, that's a good title, you know, because it definitely, you know, captures the thought, you know, someone that you're a prey is always, of course, something that you're chasing, you know. Right. So let's talk about the things that you have in this book, some of the tips that you had. So one of the things is how to achieve all of your goals in life. Talk about some of the things that people need to consider if they're trying to achieve goals. And I'm assuming the goals can be any financial, career, you know, personal. So talk to us about what you mean by that.
Okay. So how to achieve all your goals in life. One of the biggest tips that helped me with achieving my goals and still achieve my goals right now is I attach deadlines to my goals. I set goals, because it's one thing to say, okay, I want to buy a house one day, but there's another thing to attach a deadline to that goal of buying that house. Okay, so I can say I want to buy a house one day, or I can say I want to buy a house by March 3rd, 2021, and being that more specific with that deadline motivate me towards that goal. So every day I wake up, I know I'm working towards, okay, March 3rd, 2021, I need to be in my house. So therefore, I need to make sure I take care of my credit right now, take care of my personal finance, or whatever the case may be. You know, or, you know, that could be anything. That could be if you want to lose weight as well. You know, just attach an ideal date that you would like to be at or make progress at by an ideal date. That was one tip that really helped me when it came to my goals. You know, I just having those deadlines and forcing myself, put some fire up under me with deadlines, because I told myself if I don't make it by this deadline, then I felt like, okay, I'm kind of gonna in a way let myself down, so let me make sure I meet this deadline, you know. And which things come up in life, so, you know, deadlines will be altered, but the point is having a deadline to where, or like an ideal date that would get you from where you are today to that goal by that ideal date. I think one other tip that helped me was having a partner to hold me accountable. So having somebody in my corner that I can call, that can call me and that, hey Jared, so where you at with your book? You know, I have friends that were calling me while I was in the process of writing my book to asking me, okay, hey, are you still on track for your June 12th release? Are you still on track for your June 12th release? And I gave them permission to do that because I needed extra accountability for me to make sure that I'm going to hit my goals. You know, I feel like we all can help one another out here. We all should help one another. And so, you know, but help comes in many different forms. You know, help doesn't just require me giving you money in order to help. You know, help could be, you know, just me calling you just to make sure that you're on track with hitting your goal or your deadline or something like that. So just having friends that want to see you win, or having family that's gonna hold you accountable for your goals, you know, just like they are their goals. You know, that's a big one, and everything. And one other solid tip that I have for reaching goals is getting first thing in the morning and at night before I go to bed, reading those goals out loud to myself. Just repeating those goals to myself every single morning and every single night kept me motivated towards those goals, because I knew what I was working towards. I kept saying it to myself over and over. I kept telling myself about the goals over and over. And that right there just gave me more natural motivation to go and get it.
And you mentioned something that's so, so important, that, you know, if you have a goal, you have to have a deadline to it, you know. So, you know, because if you don't have a deadline, then it's just kind of wishful thinking. You know what I mean? Like, I like to buy a house, and that's nice to tell people, but then you got to put some, you know, some meat to it. Like, okay, how much do you need? When do you want the money? You know, have you talked to any real estate agents? Make sure you qualify, you know, whatever. So that is some good information, because a lot of people, you know, will share that they want to do XYZ, but they're not willing to put in the time, you know.
Right.
Do you find that when you're talking and coaching people, that, you know, if they have a goal, whatever it might be, that sometimes they got to change their lifestyle? So let me give you an example. So let's say, for example, you want to start a business. Now, there's things, as you well know, that you have to do to start that business. So you got to, you know, take out some time to devote to whatever it is you're going to do and what it's going to require. But just like with anything else, if your lifestyle is such that you work a 9-to-5, you come home, get something to eat, and then you sit in front of the TV for 4 or 5 hours and then go to bed every night, if that's your lifestyle, you're going to have to change something. You know what I mean? You got to move something out of the way to fit that in. Do you find that to be the case with a lot of folks, that they not willing to do that, or you got to coach them through that process?
Yeah, I do. I find that a lot. I get a lot of people that contact me that want me to help mentor them through starting their business or reaching their personal goals in life. And the first question I ask them when they come to me and they say, hey, Jared, I want to start a business, or I want to go into this business. And the first thing I ask them, how's your personal life? Like, how's your personal lifestyle? That will let me know if you are right now ready to start a business, or if you're not, you know, because I have to let them know, you know, starting a business, it sounds good to everybody, and it sounds good. You know, everybody love the idea to work for yourself and you know, create financial freedom. But however, though, you know, depending on your personal lifestyle, it's gonna let me know if you are gonna take your business serious and you're gonna take yourself serious. So you have to make a certain lifestyle changes, which is also what I'm discussing in my book as well. You have to be able to make lifestyle changes that will help you become a pretty good business owner and take it serious. You know, you can't say, hey, I want to start a business, but you watching 40 hours of TV every week while you're also working a 40-hour job. That's 80 hours of your time gone. We get 168 hours a week. You know, so if you work 40 and you put another 40 towards watching TV, then you already 80 hours of the 168 hours gone, you know. And so I kind of coach them through that, through a lifestyle change, and tell them that you really have to evaluate your personal lifestyle if you want to achieve certain goals in life, whether it's starting a business or even if it's healthiness, you know, I mean, you have to be able to give up some lifestyle change. You can't say, I just want to go on a diet, you know, starting Monday, and then your diet reverts back to your old ways. You know, it has to be a lifestyle change. You know, you don't just go on a diet for a few weeks and then you go back to your old ways, because when you go back to the old ways, then your old diet is going to return. So you have to be able to in your mental, you have to be able to tell yourself, this is a lifestyle change. So when I make changes in my life, I tell people, this is a lifestyle change. This is just not no temporary change. This is not nothing that I want to do just because it's popular right now. No, this is a lifestyle change.
And you're so right on. I had a visit with my doctor on yesterday, and you know, I lost back in, I want to say February. I got sick. I had the flu. I believe I had the COVID at the time. They just didn't know it. But anyway, and I lost 15 pounds. I lost 15 pounds in about, I say, 2 to 3 weeks, right? And I was like, yeah. I was feeling terrible, but I lost weight. But, of course, since then, I've gained it all back. And he said to me, he said, you know, counting calories is good. He said, but you need to eliminate those carbs. And that's the rices and the potatoes and the, and then he said something that really, you know, just disappointed me. He said, you got to give up those sweets. I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, the cakes and all that kind of stuff, cookies. He said, it's not the icing and the chocolate that gets you. It's the carbs. So when you eat cake, you know, it's the bread, you know, in the cake or in the cookies or whatever, you know, donuts or whatever I'm eating. And so, back to your point, that would be a lifestyle change for me, because I'm used to having at least a cookie or a piece of cake or whatever every day for dessert. And so that means, you know, I have to, you know, give those up. And that's a lifestyle change for me. And so I've got to be willing to do that. If I'm not willing to do that, all the exercising is not going to help, because those carbs won't there, you know, you know, and deal with that. So I think that's so important for people to understand that. So how do you sustain that success? That's one of the things you talk about. How do you sustain? I mean, once you get there, you know, how do you sustain it? Now, like in your case, you're out there doing the speaking, you wanted to do this. How do you sustain that success? What do you do?
Right. Because it's so easy. And the reason why I touch on that, because it's so easy to go get success or to elevate yourself to a certain point. Like, for example, it's so easy to work a job that pays you $30 an hour, but you started at $18 an hour, but you're now making $30. And so it's so easy to, once you get to 30, to spend more money, because now you make more money. But in order to sustain your financial freedom or sustain where you are or to maintain that job, that good paying job, you have to keep showing up every day. A lot of people, once they get in and once they get all the way in, they get comfortable and they get a little bit too complacent, and they stop showing up every day. And so what I mean by stop showing up every day, they stop doing the things that they did to go get that job or they stop doing the things that they did to achieve that goal weight that they were aiming for, or they stop doing whatever. So they stop showing up every day. So one way to sustain it is, or the biggest way to sustain your success is you have to continue to show up every day as if you don't have it, and like, as if you have to keep showing up every day. One example I give of that, one prime example that I give, you know, I mean, everybody thinks differently of Tom Brady. Some people call him a cheater. Some people call him the greatest of all time quarterback. But all in all, one reason that I took from Tom Brady or even Michael Jordan, you know, if you go back to the Last Dance documentary, even Michael Jordan, the reason why those guys were great at the top of their game is because they showed up every day. Even after they won their first championship ring, they became even more hungrier and they continue to show up every day. They had to continue to show up to practice. They had to continue to watch game, study film. You know, they had to continue to be that same hungry rookie that came in. Tom Brady was drafted in the sixth round, and he was backup quarterback his first year. But once he got the opportunity to start, he didn't turn back. But he knew that if he did not continue to show up every day, that he could have been replaced by another quarterback who was backing him up, because he was once that backup quarterback. So he knew in order for him to stay in the league over 20 years and bring six championships to the Patriots organization, he had to continue to show up every single day. You know, he had to continue to do those small dirty work, the small things every day. That's how you sustain your success. You know, you have to continue to show up. If you don't show up, then you are losing. I mean, it's real easy to gain, but it's very hard. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to gain, but it's very easy to lose. You know, you can lose it all today, you know, but just by falling back and by not doing the same actions that you took to get there. So once you get there, you have to keep that mentality to keep going.
And that's it. You make a very, very key point, you know, when you talk about the Michael Jordan. And this is a sports analogy, excuse me, but it can apply to your life. So, you know, in The Last Dance, you saw when they won the championship, you know, and I think this is from that Last Dance, because I watched so much motivational stuff. I remember when, you know, he was finished. And it may be some other athlete, but the point is I want to make is that he had won the championship, and his trainer or whoever he works out with said, okay, take a week off or whatever, what you going to do? How, you know, and he said, I'll see you in the morning. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, hey,
yeah.
I'm on that trip. You know, I said, like, cause, and I remember Magic Johnson talking about someone that motivated him was Larry Bird, because, you know, his thing was that, hey, I know Larry Bird is shooting 400 jump shots a day. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I got to be on it because I got to be ready for him, you know? And so, you know, you have to do the same thing every day that got you there. And you may have to do a little bit more, you know, because,
right,
you know, if you're in corporate America, there's somebody looking to take your job, right? There's someone looking to do better than you. You know, if it's in sports, there's someone looking to take your job. So, you know, what I find, you say, well, how are some people in the NBA, NFL, or whatever are successful and others are just mediocre? And I remember talking to, you know, to an athlete, you know, I think it was when I had my financial planning practice, he played for the Kansas City Chiefs. And he was telling me, he says, a lot of people, when they get to the NFL or get to the NBA, it's like hitting the lottery. You know, you get $5, $10 million, whatever it is, and you're like, I made it. And then they don't go about perfecting their craft and adding something to it, because when you're at that level, that elite level, whether it's in sports or business or whatever, there's always someone who is looking to take your job, to take your customers, take your position, you know, at work, take your position on the football or basketball team. So you've got to elevate yourself and say, okay, I got to get more knowledge. I've got to become, you know, manic about this, because if not, then you're going to slip back, because there's always somebody, you know, coming after you. And I know in the NFL, the tenure in the NFL is only like 3 or 4 years. I know that.
Right.
I don't know about the NBA, but you have to remember that, you know, in college, there's always, I mean, I'm sorry, in professional sports, there's always a new crop of rookies coming in. So they pushing somebody out, right? Yeah, they pushing somebody.
Right.
And same thing in business, you know, is that, you know, wherever you are, it's like, am I doing what I can to keep my skills at the top of the game? Am I improving myself? Am I adding value? You know, I mean, if I got that senior exec position or just got a ground level position, how am I going to move up? How am I going to make a difference? And so the things that you're talking about is making sure that, you know, you do the same thing every day and maybe even add to it is so important. So building a positive legacy, you talk about that in your book. Can you share what you mean by that?
Yeah, so building a positive legacy, and the reason why I said the word positive in there is because a lot of times, you know, when our loved one pass away, and not a lot of time, but, you know, sometimes, some cases, you know, they don't really leave behind a positive legacy or not many positive memories that or anything that their children or family can continue to build upon. You know, like, for example, if I spend my whole life, you know, drinking and smoking every day and things like that, you know, that's not really, and then I die, and then my kids don't have anything, that's not really leaving behind a positive legacy for mm-hmm. my children or for my family to build upon. But if I'm showing up every day and I'm trying to build a business, or I'm trying to build investment, or I'm trying to build anything positive in my personal life already, that, and so when I do die, my children can see the positive work that I was trying to build for them. That's something that can be a positive motivation for them to continue to build upon. So a positive legacy. You know, I think, in most cases, a lot of people, we don't do enough planning for our death. I think a lot of people, we are afraid to die, and you know, and which can seem like a scary thing, but we don't do enough planning for our death. So we don't prepare our children for our death, or prepare our family for our death. And so what I mean by that is, we're not doing things right now in our personal life that would leave our children with a positive legacy for them to carry out or build upon, you know. And one of my financial advisors, he sat me down and he brought that to my attention a while back, and he was the reason why I was motivated on getting life insurance, because you know he was saying, okay, you can go out and you can do this and you can live your life, but if you don't have anything to leave behind for your children, then what really have you accomplished? You know, if you did not prepare your children for your death, then what really have you accomplished in your life if your children still have to start over at zero or start behind the eight ball? So that's the reason why I touched on leaving a positive legacy, because we have to take our death planning serious, we have to take our legacy serious. Everything that we do every day is becoming a part of our legacy. If you are doing something positive or negative, it's all becoming a part of your legacy. The question is, when you die, how do you want to be remembered, and what do you want your kids to carry on? What kind of habits do you want your kids to carry on? Do you want your kids to carry on poor habits, poor financial habits, continue to carry those on, or do you want your kids to carry on wealth building habits? But all of that lies in you. And even though we talk about the word legacy, and the word legacy of, you know, most time when we say the word legacy, you know, it be men that think about the word legacy, but that goes for men and women as well. You know, we all should take accountability, and we all should take planning for our death very serious, especially for our children. And every day when we wake up, we should know, we should ask ourselves, okay, what am I doing today that's going to leave me a good legacy, a good positive generational legacy behind for my children to be proud to carry on?
And see, now you said you just blessed my spirit when you said that, because I've been saying that for a long time, you know, in terms of one thing that I wanted to hone in on what you said, leaving a legacy and getting life insurance. You know, we talk about, I'm sure you heard the statistics, that when we compare black wealth to white wealth, I mean, you know, we're way far behind, okay? And I forgot what the figures are. It's like maybe a African-American family may have $10,000 in wealth, whereas a white family like $100,000, okay? Big difference. And if we wanted to make a difference and impact this wealth gap, and we could do it in one generation, if every African-American mom, dad, whatever, went out and got enough life insurance, okay, all right? And, see, it's not enough to get the life insurance. That's important, because you'll leave that to your kids. The second part of that is to show them what to do with the money, okay? So, you know, you leave somebody $100,000. Because, you see, we keep thinking, and I know we all about reparations, and we should try to go get that, but, I mean, this is something where if you left $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, or whatever in life insurance, and you showed your kids how to manage it, what to do with it, we can resolve this whole wealth gap in one generation. So the question then becomes, why? why don't our people understand that life insurance is important? And let me guess why. Maybe you could tell me, based on the young folks that you talk to, why. Because life insurance is not something that you're necessarily going to benefit right now. It's an expense that's going out that you, in your mind, a lot of people think this way, that you're not going to get any return on it. But see, I've always felt that if you're not willing to get life insurance to leave for your loved ones, your wife, your kids, whatever, then you don't really love them. You say you do, but why? And you made something very important that you said that I wanted to key in on this, that why do we have this? Why does the next generation have to start at zero? Okay? You know, my dad owned two dry cleaners. He died, left us with nothing. Why did I have to start all over again? Why do I have to start at zero? Because white folks leave folks money, okay, all right, when they die. And, no, everybody's going to die. It's just a matter of time. And so if we did that, we can resolve and solve this wealth gap in one generation. But we're looking – I don't even know what people think anymore. I mean, so when you talk to people, Jared, about something like that, the legacy and leaving life insurance, what's the response you get from that? How do people give you some blowback on that, or do they?
Yeah, they do. One blowback that I do get is, like you said, you know, many people, they don't see the instant gratification from it. They just see it as an extra expense. They don't see it as the long-term play. And so my goal is to help them understand the long-term play. I play chess daily, so I always break things down in the chess analogy for a lot of people, because in the game of chess, you know, you have some people who try to come out and try to set you up in two or three moves and try to checkmate you. But mm-hmm. I call those amateurs chess, because when you're playing against somebody who knows how to play chess, then you're going to, you know, that those little quick hit moves are going to backfire on you because you're looking for that instant gratification. And so I let people know you have to have a long-term plan and effect. You know, you have to have a long-term game plan for your family. So I set people down, and then I break it down. I show them my plan, my long-term plan, and I show them my stress, my chest analysis. And then so I let them know, you know, you may not see the benefit of the life insurance today because you're still living and you may see this as an extra expense. But, you know, should you get in a car accident or should something happen to you when you – because we never know our time of death. Nobody does. And so should your time of death arrive at moment's notice, then – the question is, okay, what would your children have? You know, what would your children have? Or you know, so I encourage and I coach people through having these kind of conversations with their spouses and with their children. My daughters are still very young. My oldest one, I'm starting to teach her some of the language because she's a little bit more advanced for her age. So I'm trying to teach her some of the language, but the main person I talked about all this is my wife. I let her know, hey, if something happened to me, this is the plan. You know, this is the amount of money you guys will have, and this is what I need you to do with the money that's going to be left. I need this right here to go towards these investments or whatever the case may be to make sure that our children are not starting off behind the eight ball or not starting off at zero, because we have to, like I said, you have to close that gap. And we have to make those changes, and we have to stop going from generation to generation and treating as though it's normal to struggle. There's nothing normal about struggling, but we make it normal because that's all we know growing up. But we have to get to a point where, okay, I don't want my children to start up ahead. Okay, even if I don't make it to my goals, or even if my company don't make it to doing $5 million in sales, $10 million, or whatever the case may be, then I still need to make sure I got something in protection that will protect me or protect my family and leave my children with enough amount of money behind that would not leave my family in a financial stress or financial burden. Because when you die, you know, that's already like family already grieves because of your death. So don't don't have them breathing over your desk and have them financially stressed out as well. The finances should be the last thing that they should be worrying about by the time you're dead or whenever you die. The finances should be the last thing that they should be worried about. They should be able to grieve in peace, grieve and comfort after your death. And so that's one thing I bring to people's attention when I sit them down or when I talk to them about the importance of life insurance and just the importance of leaving behind that positive legacy.
And that's a good thing, because one of the things that has come out with the police brutality issue that we're dealing around the country is that if you've noticed that when these victims of police, these tragic, unconscionable deaths that happen at the hands of police, one of the things you find is that the persons that are deceased, folks have to raise money to bury them. And a lot of folks, male and female, have kids and stuff like that. So, and I guess I'm looking at that, and I'm not pointing it out to say this to disparage their legacy. What I'm pointing out is that all of a sudden, when you dumb it down to, say, someone just dies naturally, everybody got to put together their little nickels. You got to call Pookie and this person, Lakeisha,
right.
and James and all this. Put the money together to bury your dad, your mom, or your sister, your brother, your cousin. And there's something wrong with that, okay? And so we need to recognize that if we want to help the next generation, that's something that we need to consider. And I think in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, they raised a whole bunch of money. And then here with Rashad, they've raised a ton of money. So we could raise money to do some things. And, of course, it comes from the emotion. But I'm just talking about on an individual, man to man, woman to woman, whatever, that you need to make sure you have enough life insurance. And when you're young, when your kids are young, that's when you need the most. So to give you an example, my kids were young, my oldest daughter is 38, right? So, I have four girls. And so when they were young, I had $1 million policy, okay? And if something happened to me, okay, all right, something happened to me, that money would come into, I had to set up what we call an irrevocable trust. And what that is that it's a vehicle that receives the money for my minor children. You say, well, why do you have to have a trust? I said, well, first of all, people don't understand that a minor cannot accept that money. They say, why not? I said, because the money has to go into a bank or some type of account. Ain't nobody going to bring you $1 million in cash. I guess they could, but still, you put it into a bank. Well, guess what? If you open up a bank account, if you're a minor, you can't open up a bank account because you're a minor, because a minor can't sign a contract, and a bank account is a contract. So you could get an account and have your parents on it. That's one way to do it, but they can't receive the money, so the money has to go somewhere. So anyway, it would go into irrevocable trust, and then at certain points in their life, they'd get money to do certain things. My sister was the executor of it. So, for example, they would get, say, $100,000 at 18, then at 22, if they graduate college, they get another $100,000, $200,000, whatever, to get them started. And it would go like that, because if you give $1 million to an 18-year-old, you know they're going to go out and buy them a Maserati, have a party and all that
right.
kind of stuff. So, yeah, so I applaud you for being so progressive in doing that. We're almost out of time. I want to give you a chance to share people how they can get in touch with you, how they can get your book, how they can, secure you as a speaker. So you want to share that information, Jared?
Yes, sir. Everybody can reach me at my website to book me for speaking, to buy my book, or to just reach out to me through social media. My social media on Facebook is Jared J. Smith. My Instagram is j.anders_inspires. That's my Instagram handle. And my website that I can get booked for speaking or just to purchase my book is jandersinspires.com. jandersinspires.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Jared, I am so impressed. Talking to young brothers like you give me hope. for the next generation that, you know, it's not where you start out, it's where you end up. You know, so where you start out is not necessarily where you're going to end up. And you have a great story, and I'll do all I can to make sure, you know, that, you know, your book is promoted. And so I thank you so much for being on Your Personal Finance, sir. Much success to you, okay?
Sir, I thank you, and I appreciate you for having me on.
Yes, okay, take care now. Yeah, that's a great, great young man. I'm telling you, I'm encouraged, and I am motivated, and I am inspired because, you know, to hear brothers like that, 27, you know, and the reason I say that because, you know, I'm around, I mentor these kids, you know, who are, you know, between 12 and 14 years of age, who are in middle school where I work and stuff, and to hear this brother say, hey, he confirmed in me some of the issues. And so I'm going to try my best to get him to talk to, you know, some of my students and share his story because he has shared all the things that make a difference in the life of kids who are growing up in poverty, that you, it's not where you start, it's where you end up and where you're going, okay? And that's so, so, so important. And he has a great story. He just pretty much confirmed all the things that I already knew about, you know, growing up in poverty in Atlanta or anywhere in the country, but that's not where you have to stay. And he has a great spirit, and I'm just energized by what he's doing. The other thing I'm energized by is the path that I'm on in making sure that the financial lives of individuals have been impacted by the things that I do. And I, you know, started this second business. I've had several businesses, but this is the second one that my wife and I have started. We have a real estate business where we invest in property and rent it out, and that's great. You know, we're getting anywhere from 20 to 25% on our money. You hear me? 20 to 25%. Unbelievable, you know. And so that's exciting. But to fund that business, you know, because all in real estate, you want to use other folk money, that we started a second business where we provide financial services to individuals like you who are looking, one, to improve their financial lives, getting a financial plan together, whether for savings, for budgeting, monitoring your net worth, making sure you have wills and trusts for your kids. And then the other portion of it is the credit restoration, credit building, credit monitoring, debt payoff side of the equation. It's called Financial Education Services. And I am so excited because it's allowing us to help people, but also make some money in the process. So if you're hearing this broadcast, no matter where you are in the United States, and you're interested in one, helping, getting help, increasing your credit score, eliminating negative stuff off your credit and making sure your credit's monitored and budgeting and saving and all that kind of stuff, then, you know, give me a call. You can reach me. You can call or text me at 404-272-4633. That's 404-272-4633. And also, of course, you can email me at Charles Ross, all one word, at Outlook.com, OUTLOOK.com, and I'll get some information for you to help you make a decision about where you are in life and where you want to go. Thank you so much for listening to this broadcast, downloading it or whatever the case may be, and I will be talking with you soon.